My advice would be go with the big or the biggest model that you can find. See if it solves your problem. Then using techniques like distilling, fine-tuning, and there are many others, quantization, see if you can make the model smaller.
80% of all AI pilots fail. And that's according to the Harvard Business Review. I did my homework, y'all. 4 out of 5, just dead on arrival. And yet, everywhere we look, it's AI everything. So what is actually going on behind the scenes? How do pilots go from something promising to a pilot graveyard? And if it is working, when and where do you double down on the winners? I am beyond thrilled to ask these questions and many more to my guests today. We'll chat first with Anupam Singh, who is the VP of AI and Growth at Roblox. Anupam, thanks so much for coming on. I'm a huge fan of the game and the company.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm really, really well. Now, Anupam, though, I'm curious, please tell us a bit about your journey that you took in order to get to your current role.
I am a two-time founder of two big data companies. The second one went on to be acquired by Cloudera. So if you've ever heard about Hadoop, if you've ever played with open source big data platforms, there's a lot you can blame me for and what works, what does not work.
Well, can you tell me also about some of your experience with building AI pilots then before Roblox and now at Roblox? I know that you mentioned a little bit of it there, but I want to dig deeper.
Oh, yeah. So AI, used to be called machine learning before everybody started calling it AI. So we've been doing machine learning for a long, long while. Take Roblox, for instance. We've had a text filter for our safety for years and years, where if you and I were texting each other, and let's say you decided to use a colorful word, our text filter would inline live hashtag it, meaning it's bleeping but for text. And that always used machine learning. It is invoked around 4 billion times a day. Imagine every one of your texts going through this text filter being filtered out. And that was our biggest machine learning service before all of AI became the rage in the industry.
Out of those pilots then, how many of them failed?
It's interesting. If you narrow down the problem the way I described it, so we are not trying to boil the ocean. We're not trying to do AGI. You simplify the problem statement rather than trying to boil everything. And so some of the failed things that we have seen is when we try to do too much in one go, because we get excited about the technology. You must have heard something called time to first token. This is all the rage in AI. It's the time that it takes to get the first token. I have started calling something time to first demo. In AI, building a demo is easy, but never confuse the demo with actual production.
Never confuse the demo with actual production. Can you break that down for me a little more?
So let's say you have a video building software or you are trying to build photos. One of my AI friends calls it party trick models. Party trick models is you open your phone and you say, I want dolphins riding bicycles on Ocean Beach in San Francisco. Comes out and it's beautiful. Well, firstly, it's not useful to anything. It's apropos nothing. Now, if you want to build a real video or a 3D world, which has Ocean Beach, which has the fog of San Francisco, which has dolphins, it's a much bigger task. So the demo sometimes confuses people. I have other companies where people have gone to the board and demoed something, and the board assumes that it is the full product. We try to avoid that. We try to avoid irrational exuberance around AI demos.
Well, then how widespread is this issue of irrational exuberance?
Honestly, because so many models are now available, so many large models are so easily available, I think it's become more common now because you can ask, the model can almost fool you into thinking that you just solved a very complex business use case, but it really hasn't.
I'm very curious about where does this usually start, though, within the company or within the organization? Does it start in the C-suite or more so on the developer level?
At some level, it's at the developer level, because earlier, if you did AI before the large models, you would have to start with the data. you'd have to figure out which neural network technique you're going to use, and then you have to figure out about the output. But now, because large models are available off the shelf, and many companies are making them accessible, your first step is much easier as a developer. Now, all of it portends well for the future, but just because it is easy to do the first step, people confuse it with the end, with the conclusion of the project.
Does that make it almost too easy to step into piloting?
In some ways, yes. It is very easy to articulate a business problem, have a demo ready, and in your mind, you're now not thinking about cost, you're not thinking about data quality, and you're not thinking about user experience. If you take these three away, the project becomes easy. But if your AI model is about to curse at you, or it is going to give you factually wrong answers, how do you assure that that's not happening? And those are the last 10% of an AI project might be harder than the first 90%.
So what else are people missing as they start the piloting process?
I think the first one I would say, because Roblox is at such a high scale, we have to think about cost. We like to give out our features to all of our users and all of our creators. So from day one, we have to think about, publicly we talk about 4 billion hours of engagement. So it's 4 billion hours of people talking to each other, people playing with each other, people building content, and we need to think at that scale. So often people will forget the number of tokens that are actually going to be used. And then when you multiply it by cost of running it on the cloud, you're suddenly, your beautiful AI project could cost your company $100 million straight up, and the bills are running up the way cloud bills do. They start very innocuously, and then suddenly it's a huge cash outlay for your company.
Okay, you've identified a couple of huge problems here right then, Anupam. So I need your help now in helping us identify some hacks on how to build something that has staying power.
So number one, let's talk about cost, okay? On cost, consider whether you really need that large a model. There's a little bit of an ego battle. It's like, oh, you know, John is using a 100 billion parameter model, but Arvind is using a 10 billion parameter model. Oh, obviously 100 billion is better than 10 billion. Not true, because if your business problem is constrained enough, if your user experience question is constrained enough, you can actually work very well with 10 billion parameter model. What happens next? A 10 billion parameter model sometimes is 100 times cheaper than, let's say, 100 billion parameter model. So it's very important to constrain the problem and then use that constraint to reduce the footprint of your machine learning.
See, now you've got me in two different mindsets, though, because if I'm going to start small, how can I start to think about scalability?
When I say start small, I don't mean that you should always start with the smallest model possible. You can start with the biggest model, or whether it's open source, whether it's your own. Take the biggest model. See if it solves your user's question. Let me give you an example. We started on something called Code Assistant. Millions of creators come to our platform and they write code. Of course, having a code assistant is great, but we started with a very big model. We actually put it in what you would call a pilot. Saw that our users, our developers really like it. Then behind the scenes, because we had a gateway sitting in between, behind the scenes, we changed the model to a smaller model and tested it. We changed it to a smaller open source model. So my advice would be go with the big or the biggest model that you can find, see if it solves your problem. Then using techniques like distilling, fine tuning, there are many others, quantization, see if you can make the model smaller. So that's sort of the first step.
Gotcha. Okay, so see if I can make the model smaller. Now, let's fast forward some. I've got my pilot and I'm ready to grow now, Anupam. I want to grow. So I need a team. How easy is it going to be for me to be able to find people who have the right skills in the AI space, like right now today?
That's a brilliant question. I'll tell you why. Because whenever we think about AI, we think about models. Whenever we think about models, we start thinking about people who can train these models. But what we have learned here is the magic starts a little before which is data. So preparing data for AI is very different than preparing data for business intelligence. If you remember your business intelligence software, what does it do? It creates charts, it creates pie charts and swim lanes and whatnot. But preparing data for AI is different. You have to create vector embeddings, you have to put it into a vector database. We have learned that right now, some of it is art and some of it is science. And finding that right mix in the engineer to think about data is sort of the hardest skill in the market.
I want to give a shout out, by the way, to everyone who's listening right now, especially some engineers that I'm sure are tuning on into this one. I want you to speak directly to them, though. Let them know, how can today's engineers start learning these skills?
If you are a database person or if you're a data person, start thinking about vector databases. Start thinking about what an embedding looks like. It's not that bad. It's still a table. It's still data. Okay? Data stays data. So that's one way you can get in. The second, of course, is learn a few model optimization techniques. Not all of us have to go and build GPT. Not all of us have to build these bigger models. If you want to get your feet wet on AI, go in and just learn these techniques like RAG, fine-tuning, quantization, and just play with a model. You don't have to do the training yourself. And the third kind of engineer who will thrive, we didn't talk about performance as such. I emphasize cost, I emphasize data quality, but in the end, when you're typing in and your AI is taking too much time to respond, you as a user are not going to like it. So what is software about since many decades ago? It's about performance. And a lot of that performance is still distributed systems engineering. And so if you are a distributed systems engineer, you still have a lot to contribute because in AI inference, all of these older techniques are coming back.
Since you're here, we obviously have to talk about your work at Roblox. All right. So in your view, how's AI shaping the future of gaming?
Oh, I thought you would never ask. There's a few things that are all active simultaneously. So it's a very exciting time to be involved with Roblox and AI. So the first one is, of course, creation itself. You want to create a game, you come to the Roblox platform. We'll help you with texturing. We will help you with code assistance. Okay, your creation is ready. But now you have to send it out to millions and millions of users. In our case, it's essentially every corner of the planet. We have about 24 data centers at the edge where your creation is going to go. We have features which help you with rendering. As a creator, you don't want to spend too much time rendering it. So that's the creator. Now let's say you're a user. Now I don't know about you, but I have a really snazzy avatar on Roblox. It's got a beautiful white coat and it's got a, you know, weapon and a very nice mohawk. Imagine trying to build your avatar. It used to be painful, but avatar auto setup on Roblox immediately gets your avatar to look amazing. So just these three things, creators, users get enabled. Behind the scenes, though, one of the biggest areas of investment always has been since Roblox was founded is safety. And a lot of our AI, I would say almost half of our AI spend is on safety. Whether you are texting a friend, chatting with a friend on Roblox, and whether you can be colorful or not, that's something that our AI helps with. But the most exciting one pertinent to our conversation right now is voice. You and I are chatting. This is, you know, a professional setting. If I suddenly use the colorful word, I think we should beep it, correct?
Sure.
But now, do you want to beep in post-production or do you want to beep it in here, right? And so our voice safety effort is that depending on the context, we will actually immediately identify whether our voice interaction is safe or not. And that's been one of the most successful projects on AI. To your earlier question about pilots, I remember the pilot. It seemed very expensive. It seemed the model was too big. it seemed the data quality was not high. In a one-year journey, we have addressed each one of these things. And now the safety group is the biggest user and consumer of our AI platform.
I can only imagine the colorful language that we would hear if we just stood outside the door during that training.
We had this great demo in which our Vice President of Engineering for Safety would be talking to our founder and CEO in the town hall, and it would nudge them to be less colorful. So it's a pretty impressive demo.
Well, then what do you see coming next then? As Gen AI gets better and pilots do start improving, what's on the horizon?
Firstly, if you live in San Francisco, hopefully you have seen these driverless cars. It's amazing that literally in real time, this car is able to reason about what it is seeing, what it should do. And because San Francisco is very narrow and steep street, sometimes it has to back away to let a garbage truck go by. So in a way, I feel excited that the future is already here in certain parts of the world. So that's part one. Part two, I think all the AI excitement today is legitimately about text. You know, I type in something, it types something back. But the next horizon is image, which is already here. People are talking about image. Then we are thinking about audio. Then we are thinking about video. And then we might think about the world itself. And for us, because we live at the intersection of the real world and the virtual world, building these worlds in the most efficient way possible is a big deal. It takes too much effort for our creators to take what is in their mind and translate into working code. We want to sit in between and let you become a storyteller on robots. Versus today, what you would have to do is you would have to write some code and you'd have to learn how to, you know, build a Roblox world. Imagine you could just say it. And out pops a Roblox game, and you and I are playing that in 5 minutes. That's the future for us, at least.
So is there a world post-code then? Is that what's on the horizon?
It's possible. The beauty about AI today is, apart from obviously what we started with, yes, there's a lot of failures that we will encounter, like any other innovation. But every 3 months, an entire set of assumptions get broken, and we see something new. So it's an exciting time to be working in machine learning and AI for sure.
Then my final question with that is, with everything becoming so much more accessible, with creating pilots becoming more accessible, do you think that's going to lead to more pilot failure in the future, since people can feel so confident about it and just jump in even without a ton of experience? Or do you think that that's going to improve the quality of pilots that we get?
I'll tell you what we saw here. The sophistication will not be in the pilots. The sophistication will be AI platforms will become smarter to figure out that this is not a good use case, or that the data quality is not good, or the inference is too slow, or it is too expensive. You know how if you go back to the time when cloud was new, I could just, you know, ask my boss to give maybe their credit card and put it on the company tab, and that's it. That's my cloud pilot. Today, cloud has an entire set of disciplines, entire set of process to manage the cloud spend and performance. I think the AI platforms will become sophisticated enough that they will catch these pilots. But I think we should let creativity be unbounded. We should encourage our engineers, our developers, our creators to do a lot of new things with AI, while the platform constrains what's going on.
Okay, Anupam, thank you so much for your time. Listening to you, it makes me feel like the future is going to be super duper bright. But today, people putting their blood, sweat, and tears into pilots that never see the light of day still just breaks my heart as a creator myself. So I've called in my friend, IBM's Nick Renaud. He's going to help me to understand his point of view as one of the brilliant minds behind AI builds. Nick! Welcome back to the show, man. It's really good to see you.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, look, as someone who's really in the weeds developing individual AI projects every day, let's start here. Like, does it begin like any other creative endeavor, like just a fun idea?
The biggest thing that I always think about when I'm designing or coming up with ideas is like impact. So if I build this, how is it going to be able to be used? Who's going to be able to use it? Where is it going to go? What's the potential? Like, one of the most popular projects that actually built on YouTube was the sign language detection model. And there's been other, like a ton of other object detection models that I'd seen floating around YouTube before, but I saw, hey, this one's actually got some real use. And like, maybe I won't push this to the absolute nth degree, but if I can give people a start, it'll actually help kick people off. And I actually had a father reach out to me yesterday who's actually taking the model that I helped start designing on YouTube, and he's using object detection and embedding that inside of a set of glasses for his daughter who is blind to help identify obstacles in a way. So I thought that was a really cool sort of evolution of the project that I sort of started off with.
Jeez, how validating that must have sounded to you, like to know that something that you just dreamt of on a whim and just started, you know, doing is actually being placed in real life application. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And I mean, the funny thing is that like, there's been so many different offshoots from that project. There's obviously been others, but like this one, because it's had that greater for the greater good type feel to it or vibe to it, it's really gone a lot further.
I know clearly that you have a ton of ideas. They must just like hit you at all different points in time. But when you're trying to narrow those ideas down and when you're really trying to plan a pilot, how do you try to make sure that the pilots that you do endeavor to create actually grow up, actually make it far enough to take root?
Yeah, I think I'm going to switch speeds here, right? And then focus a little bit more on like how I do it at work as opposed to like personal projects. Because a lot of my personal ones sort of just go off the wayside, kind of like the amazing footage that you mentioned at the start. Like they're always on the to-do list. Whereas when I'm at work, I'm a lot more driven to make sure that these do grow up. So I sit within inside of an organization inside of IBM called Client Engineering. And we actually created this framework called the Pilot Engineering Method. One of the first steps when it comes to kicking off any pilot is actually looking for a specific business opportunity and then looking at use case discovery. Those two steps ensure that you're at least going down the right path to begin with. I think we're going to talk about like one of my biggest failures a little bit later on, but like the reason that pilot failed or the project that I was working on failed was because I didn't do that. So I didn't look and identify a valid business opportunity. I didn't do proper use case discovery. And then most importantly, I didn't quantify the business value. Like how much is it worth to the organization to solve this problem? Because then they're actually going to want to solve that particular problem. Like I always talk about it as refer to it as the bleeding neck problem. Like if your neck's bleeding, you really want to solve that problem, right? Is what we're trying to solve, a bleeding neck problem. So when it comes to actually going through that process, I think those two steps are critical. And that all sort of starts at the initial phases of the project, right? So actually doing workshops and working with a client, like this stuff can't happen in isolation. It's absolutely critical that when you're looking for the business case and when you're looking for the use case, that you sit down with the people that are going to be using it. Not just the project sponsor or the person funding it. It's like, is this going to be valid to the person that's actually going to be using it in their day-to-day lives? And then from there, not just sort of disconnecting, they need to be critically engaged at every particular step of that project. So once we sort of decide on that, then we really go into what we call the co-creation phase. And keep in mind, like co is the really important part in that. It's not just engineers building stuff off on their side or on their machine, just hacking away. It's building alongside our clients. And then once we've gone through that process along with a number of playbacks, it's really about transitioning this off into production, because you've probably seen it before, right? That there's a bunch of projects, they start off, they're really great, and then they never really make it out there into the wild. And that happens a lot, right? Like there's a lot of developers building a lot of stuff and like there's a lot of pilots being spun up. But if you haven't actually gone and established that business value, looking specifically at a valid use case, then there's not going to be a bleeding neck need to actually get this into production or actually use it inside the organization. So going through those steps, the workshops, the builds, the transition, we bake that into each one of our projects and our pilots to make sure that they do grow up.
When you mentioned the co part, Nick, that to me really seems to kind of like sum up everything that you shared there, because just listening to me, I'm like, wow, it would be so much fun to brainstorm and to come up with different things. But at the same time, even though that is such a thrill, that also places so much responsibility on just you as one person to stay personally motivated and to push it on through. But when you're working with a client, like, you can't just shrug it on off because you become bored of the project anymore. So since you can't plan for everything, how do you try to design your pilots so that they can adapt to what you can't know? But like at the same time, you can't know what you need to build into them. So I feel like we're stuck in this circle. So how do you fix
that?
Yeah,
there is that loop, right? Yeah, like there's the known knowns, the known unknowns, but then there's always going to be the unknown unknowns, right? This comes with every project, right? It's not just AI projects that have instances of scope creep where something creeps in and it's like, oh, this is an absolute critical thing that we didn't mention at the start that we now need to go and handle. Part of good project management sort of hedges against that, right? So like agile project management makes sure that like we're prioritizing to build stuff that is absolutely critical to ensuring that this particular pilot succeeds. A lot of the risk associated with that can be sort of hedged or mitigated against by doing that use case discovery and working alongside the client, because really quickly, if the client's testing as you're building, they'll probably point out like, oh, we can't have that field there, or oh, I need that filter there, or oh, we can't show that data because it's super sensitive and this person shouldn't have access to it. So co-creating sort of alleviates a lot of that other concern, but also doing playbacks. So whenever I do pilots, I try to make sure that anybody that is going to have a potential touch point or is going to be a decision maker for this potential solution going live needs to be in those playbacks. They need to be seeing what we're building, because you never know how one particular workflow might impact somebody else until somebody else is there in that room. So making sure that those happen proactively and not reactively is critical as well.
Well, look, it's funny because hearing you share all of that, I'm as a listener, I'm like, you know, well, it sounds like Nick has it all down. He's got it all together. So
no,
how could anything possibly go wrong?
What is it, like Bear Grylls adapt to overcome something else? Like,
right. So, but I know that that's not true because you teased us a little earlier by telling us that there was a failure. So I'm going to kind of push on the wound a little bit here, and I'm going to ask you if you can tell us some more about that failed pilot that you worked on.
Yeah, yeah. Thankfully, this wasn't a pilot at IBM, so that there's no brand rep or damage likely to occur as a result of this. A while ago, so I was just coming out of university. I was doing my master's, and as part of that, we had a startup incubator, and our startup got picked to go into the incubator and to build it out. And the whole premise of it was like, we're going to be building an application or like a solution to help increase transparency of patient journeys throughout a hospital. Because like one of the big factors when you're inside of a hospital is like, you don't really know what's happening and you don't really know what's going to be happening next. And that can really increase the stress and concern when you're going through that process or you're getting treatment. Now, I thought this was a massive problem because my girlfriend had just been through hospital. She was going through surgery and it was an absolute nightmare. Like, we went into the hospital ward one time and they're like, who are you? Why are you in this bed? And I was like,
oh no.
As if it's not enough to know what's going to be happening to us at that particular point in time. They don't know who we are. And so I'm like, does anyone know what's happening here? So I'm like, oh, this is a great idea. Like, we can help improve transparency in hospitals, improve patient experience, and that has a knock-on effect. There's a bunch of research studies that like improving patient experience ensures or like reduces the likelihood of readmissions. It improves recovery rates. It reduces like a whole ton of costs associated to that hospital and providing care for that patient. And I'm like, okay, let's build a solution for this. I can do data science. I can build machine learning models. This is awesome. We're going to bake it all into it. So we build for like 3 months, right? And we just keep building. Like, we have a meeting we actually got a hospital on board to help us out with this, right? Or like to potentially take on the solution. So we have a meeting, we're thinking about building this. I'm like, yep, great, cool, awesome, build it. So we heads down, we build for like 2 months, like just coding. Like, and so I'm working my day job Monday to Friday and then going to like the incubator from like 6 to 9 p.m., like Monday to Friday, and then I'm working Saturdays and Sundays building this up with my co-founder. Build it for 3 months. And I'm like, hey, we should be showing this back to the client and going, or like to the hospital and going, hey, what do you think about this? And at that time, we had like a startup advisor. Like he was the one that got us the contact with the hospital. And he's like, hey, at this point, right, like you've built more than an MVP, you really should be looking to get some sort of funding or get the client to start paying for licenses, even if they're just token licenses and like lifetime licenses just because they're your foundation client. I'm like, okay, great. So we've got a product, a minimum viable product, like it's enough to charge for. So we go to the client, we're like, hey, we've built it, we can hook in, we can do all of this stuff. We went through a ton of regulations to make sure that we'll build. And we're like, okay, like we've built it all up. We're going to give you like unlimited licenses for the entire lifetime, and it's going to cost you X dollars. And the client's like, yeah, but like, I don't know if we really need it now. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I'm like, I was still like, I didn't have as much experience in terms of like selling and building startups and doing like that whole process. And I just sat there in that room and I'm like, I don't even know how to interpret that. Like, what, like you don't, like there's like, you don't need it and you don't need it now. So I like, eventually I got like, I gathered myself and I'm like, okay, when do you think you would need it? They're like, oh, maybe you should go back to the drawing board and like review it. And I was just like, like eventually I recognized I was getting the cold shoulder and I'm like, oh, this is just like, we just wasted so much time. Like 3-4 months of our lives building this, like on top of like the stuff that we did in the incubator prior to the hospital. I'm like, it was just like exhausting. And like, I was like, I'm going to cut, like there is no failure, right? There's opportunities and there's lessons learned. But like at that point in time, like I can still see it. Like I was sitting in that like a demountable room because they were going through a reconstruction. Construction of the hospital. And I was like, oh man, I can't believe we didn't validate this way more. I can't believe we didn't sit down with them and like triple check that this is what they wanted, that this is what they were going to be able to pay for. And I've just gone, oh, like I could have like mitigated so much of this well ahead of time instead of waiting till the end to present that. But I mean, you live and you learn, right?
That hurts. You just painted that room for us. You dragged us back into your trauma, Nick. Thanks for that. I'm assuming that the reason that you can remember that one so well is because there are quite a few pilots that you've worked on that do succeed, right? That have succeeded. So I know you've got a bunch of those. What made those pilots different than this one? Because from where I'm sitting, it sounds as though you were able to identify like maybe a commitment going forth with everything else that you worked on. Was that one of the first things you did?
Yeah, definitely. So like when we spin up pilots now, there's a whole process, right? It's not just like, hey, you want to do a pilot? Cool, let's go do a pilot and start building, right? We actually go through ways of working. So like we set up a document of understanding. So like what we're going to deliver, what the commitment on the client is. So like, what are they going to be able to do? Do they have the sufficient amount of time to test this? Because again, it's co-creation, not just IBM creating, right? Like we're trying to build stuff to help their organizations. Close engagement with the client is absolutely critical. Like if I look back on like my startup, like we got data from the hospital, but it was like, I want to say 1% of the amount of data that we needed. So ensuring that you have the right data available, the right data prepared, and the right data collected is absolutely critical. I want to say that like a lot of the pilots that we do now are really successful because of the people, right? Like we have the right people in the right room. And that's not just IBMers, but that's also like the client coming together with their right people that are going to help push this forward and make sure that it's successful. Because ultimately, like every pilot ends with some sort of presentation to an executive or like a funder or like an executive sponsor. Having everyone in the room and making sure that the right people are in the room ensures that like when we go and make that pitch that they know that, hey, it's not just something that some random group has gone and built. It's like, this has been a collective. Like we've actually gone ahead, we've scoped this out properly, we've found a problem that needs to be solved, and we've made sure that it'll work and it'll deliver the business value that that's needed.
I imagine right now, I hope that there are a bunch of developers that are listening to us, listening to you specifically right now. Can you give them one word of advice as they think about whatever pilot it is that they're dreaming of? Give them just at least one word.
My personal favorite is fail fast. Build a prototype as quickly as you humanly can and validate it, right? So like build it, go and show it to the person that you think is potentially going to be using this or buying this. So that's really quickly going to validate or invalidate what it is that you're building. That's probably a big one around startups, right? But if we had built in what we built in like 2 weeks before, instead of getting way too far down into the MVP and said, hey, will you buy this right now? Or like, is this exactly what your organization needs? And really quickly, it's a qualifying statement or a disqualifying statement super early on. So failure is not really failure, right? It's just it's a lesson learned.
Yeah, it sounds like you fell in love with your pilot, Nick.
Oh man, 100%. I was committed. I was like, this is so cool. It's going to improve people's lives. It's going to make hospitals way better. Not that hospitals are great anyway, but like it's world changing. And like, look, I'm still kind of vested in that idea. I'd probably need to go and do a ton more research and approach it from a different way. But now I'm like, there's so many other problems that I can solve that I've got deep expertise in. Like, I'm not a doctor. I'm not I don't know the first thing about patient treatment, but I was like, I'm vested in this. I want to solve it.
Look, and you clearly have a ton of free time, so I'm sure that you'll pick this one up in your spare time, Nick.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just to, like, I'll do it between sleeping and working, right?
Well, with all that then said, well, thank you for squeezing us on in then within your time. I really do appreciate you getting on here, enlightening us. It's always a true joy to speak with you. And also, thank you again to Anupam. This has been a fantastic episode. And that's it for today's episode. So we appreciate you all for listening as always, and we will see you back here very, very soon. I promise.